Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Mike Edgerly in today for Carrie Miller. Since its founding in 1932, the BBC World Service has been, for many people around the globe, a link to the outside world. There are places where people are starved for fact-based, objective information about themselves and the world around them. The BBC World Service has been that link. This morning, we're joined by the head of the English Language Division of the BBC World Service, Mary Hockaday, to talk about the World Service and the changes in the media universe. We have big topics for you this morning, Ms. Hockaday. Welcome to NPR News.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
In full disclosure, American Public Media, the parent of NPR News, is a business partner with the BBC, distributing BBC services in this country. Just wanted everyone to know that.
Yep.
And for those of you listening, as news consumers, how do you work to make sure you have a balanced media diet? Do you have concerns about fake news or stories coming out of Britain or elsewhere in the globe? Do you have questions about how media organizations fight fake news? How do you distinguish between real and fake news? We'd like to hear from you this morning in our conversation with Mary Hockaday. You can reach us at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828, 800-242-2828. You can also tweet me at Edgerly NPR News. That's E-D-G-E-R-L-Y NPR News. Ms. Hockaday, tell us, in this age of fake news and challenges to the credibility of responsible news organization and the proliferation of digital devices, how in the world does the BBC World Service maintain its credibility and trust around the globe? That's an easy question, but probably not a simple question.
Well, in some ways, the answer is simple. We keep on keeping on. You know, you're right. I completely agree that this is a time of great challenge. We've seen through digital media a kind of explosion in choice, in devices, in ways that people can communicate, which in many ways is a terrific thing. But in other ways, it's caused lots of challenges. As we all know, fake news or just a mistake can travel the world in seconds. It can flash around. How do we deal with that? How do we also deal with governments, regimes who are in a very deliberate way manufacturing the news or trying to disrupt understanding? You know, these are big challenges, but they're not actually new challenges. You know, propaganda has been with us all for a very, very long time. Fake news, mistakes, distortion, repression, a lack of freedom of expression, again, been with us all for a very, very long time. So in some ways, we stick to what we've always done. Our job is to report, to report accurately, fairly, impartially, and to bring a really good depth of expertise to help explain stories, and then air a really broad range of debate on a topic and to hear from, you know, a really broad range of voices who might have something to say about a subject.
You do that day in and day out. That's your stock in trade. But what do you say when a government official or someone says, no, that's not true. Russia had nothing to do with the poisoning of that gentleman and his daughter. And that's just not true.
Well, we...
What do you do then?
What do we do? And, you know, you raised the story of the poisoning of the Skripals in Salisbury. And it's been, you know, such an interesting and a kind of test case for some of this stuff. So, you know, on the one hand, we report what the British authorities are saying. And then, of course, we will report what the Russians said in response. But we will also use our own journalistic expertise to add insight and to add judgment. So some of that was about our science correspondents getting involved and, you know, reporting on the kind of history of nerve agents and really trying to understand how something like that could happen. We had our reporters in Moscow who were well able to report directly on what was being said there, but also to put in context the Russian government style of information and actually disinformation and the judgment they could bring to bear about a history of Russian attempts to, you know, confuse or disrupt. But also at the same time, we're holding the British government to account and really challenging them around what's the evidence for what they're saying, mm-hmm. what can they say publicly, what can they refer to, but of course it's, you know, secret intelligence, but we will explain that to audiences. So we're hopefully giving audiences the full facts of a story, but also the layers of insight and illumination that explain why things may be as they are and to help listeners make up their own mind. We serve as a kind of trusted guide for people through the news.
And how did you get to this place where you are a trusted guide? I mean, and not just in your home country, but in far-flung places.
Yeah.
How did you get there?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And in some ways, I'm back where I started. We kind of keep on keeping on. I mean, I think the first thing is we are able to say that we are obliged. It is in our charter for the BBC to be serving the public in the UK and internationally with accurate, fair, objective news. So, you know, it's our job. But really how you build trust is by doing it right day in, day out. We have people, reporters in 74 countries around the world. We have terrific teams in the newsroom in London. You know, we have a great bureau in Washington and mm-hmm. other reporters in the States. And we also have a lot of ways that people can tell us if we're getting it wrong. You know, we have a lot of accountability systems. And the other way I think you crucially earn trust, I think, sure, it's something, you know, good journalists in the States would recognize, is that, you know, we're human. Occasionally a mistake is made. If somebody points that out or we realize we've made a mistake, we will own up to it and we will be honest, and which I think is a very, you know, it's
and
an important
do
way
that?
Of building trust.
How do you do that? What's that look like if you've made a mistake in Africa,
yeah.
covering East Africa, you make a mistake. What happens then?
Yeah, well, you know, fortunately, we don't do it very often.
Right.
But of course, you know, occasionally we do. You know, it depends. I mean, if it's a really significant mistake or even just a, you know, a small but important and real mistake, we will report it on air. We will go back over the story. Now, of course, you have a lot of issues, you know, online with digital. So we may need to do an update on the story. You know, mm-hmm. Occasionally, more likely if it's a legal problem, we might actually take something down. But, you know, if we've made a mistake, it's about kind of correcting, explaining and moving on. But as I say, you know, fortunately, we don't do it too often.
Right. I'd like to ask you about another story that's been in the news that affects global media, and that's the attack in Syria. Just this week, we learned that it was the Russians, I believe, and Syrian government leaders were saying actually it was carried out by someone else. It was organized out of Great Britain somewhere.
Yeah.
What do you do with that? How do you pivot on a story like that when such a direct accusation is made that affects such an important global story?
Well, you know, if you back up a little bit, mm-hmm. for days what we had been doing is reporting the real story on the ground. I mean, I think very often what we're trying to do, definitely relevant here in the States actually with the kind of hurtling on of the story in the States, is sort of get below the canopy of, you know, he said, she said, and kind of froth and tweets and whatever, and get down to the floor of the forest. So we have had reporters based in Syria and in the surrounding countries for, you know, years who have been methodically and painstakingly reporting this war. There are times when they have not themselves been able to get to a particular location, but we have a network of contributors who we work extremely hard to verify. We have a really good team in the newsroom who are just geniuses at verifying photos, images, sources. So we have been reporting day in, day out. So we reported the original attack, the chemical attack.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for sure you then go through the politics. You know, who's saying this? Who's claiming that? We will bring our defense correspondents to bear. We will bring our regional experts. And then we have terrific, terrific specialists. You know, people like Jeremy Bowen, our Middle East editor, who listeners, you know, in the mm-hmm. States will well have heard on NewsHour, which runs here on, mm-hmm. you know, NPR.
Yep.
So hopefully, you know, one or two people that people can hear and recognize that these are people of deep knowledge and deep commitment to telling the story. So by the time you have the Russians saying, oh, it wasn't us, you have already been able to explain the regional impact, what Russia and the other players have been doing, Syria's previous track record on chemical weapons, and, you know, for listeners at that point, able to put into perspective and understand that this is what Russia does. It mm-hmm. likes to obfuscate, disrupt, you know, so we'll report it. But our job is not to create a false equivalence between, you know, he said, she said. We're trying to say, in this case, you know, listen to Xi. She's got a track record and more history or whatever. So that's the way we work these things through.
And really being on the ground is what makes the difference. Yep. When these stories evolve into something like this, an attempt to change the narrative entirely from the original facts, right?
Yeah.
Because you were there when it happened or you reported it when it happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Our guest in this hour on NPR News is Mary Hockaday. She's the controller?
Controller.
Controller.
You know, it's a funny job title. It's a very old-fashioned job title,
Of the BBC World Service English. You can hear, by the way, BBC News Hour each weekday at 2 on NPR News, plus a host of World Service programming, starting at 11 in the evening and going all the way to 4 a.m. here on NPR News. We also get BBC updates. During Morning Edition, we often turn to the BBC World Service for coverage of breaking news around the globe where our partner National Public Radio may not be able to respond quite as quickly. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, and I was interested when you were talking about the history of what we do, Mike, and you're absolutely rightly saying that some of our services are reaching people who have no other access to accurate information about the world or indeed sometimes about their own country. But of course, actually, we are also a broadcaster, a global broadcaster for the world. And that includes being heard here in the States, where people have access to loads of information.
Right.
So, you know, in a way, what are we here for? What are we doing? What can we contribute? But I like to think, and actually, you know, the evidence is from the many stations around the States that take some of our programs and the great response we get from listeners, that we can add something to the mix. We can complement what, you know, you're doing at NPR, kind of locally, statewide, and NPR nationally. And then we can bring that different perspective, a really rounded global picture, and also a kind of different view on the States and what's happening here.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But let's go to the phones. Mark in Mound, you're on with Mary Hockaday.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate what you're doing now, but I'm kind of curious as to how you initially encountered the fake news. I believe it was in the 80s when I first experienced it, looking at an English newspaper as I was a tourist, and saw what was going on with your newspapers and the sensationalism that was occurring at that point in time, thinking that we are, in the U.S., babes in the woods compared to you folks. And so what were your seminal steps that you were taking at that point in time? Because I remember seeing Rupert Murdoch then and thinking, okay, in his work there, and thinking, this is what's occurring here now. And then when I learned that he had bought U.S. interests, papers, media, I thought, oh, this is going to be brilliant. And I believe that's what we're living in the midst of.
No, that's really interesting, Mark. Really, really good to hear from you. It's so interesting. You know, we share a lot between us, don't we, the Brits and the Americans, but we also have some crucial differences in the media landscape. So, you know, the time you're talking about, but actually way back, you know, the 19th century, the 18th century, the tradition in Britain of newspapers has always been a certain kind of rambunctiousness, you know, strong views, strong voice, strong stories, strong headlines, you know, a kind of battle of ideas and views with also, you know, terrific great news reporting through them. But the sense that the newspapers have a, you know, strong, clear voice and the public kind of knows where they're going, which they're choosing, maybe their favourite, but they also enjoy to keep an eye on others. And then alongside that, you know, emerging through the 20th century, broadcasting and broadcast news in Britain, including the BBC, has always been regulated for impartiality. So all the main news broadcasters in Britain, whether like us publicly funded or the commercial news operations, are all obliged to treat television and radio news as a service of, you know, fact-based and impartial and balanced coverage. So it's a very different landscape. So, you know, I'm sorry to hear that you were sort of disturbed by what you saw in the 80s. In some ways, that's part of our tradition. We can place it in a context, knowing that the broadcast news is always a reference for a, you know, slightly different way of treating the news. I mean, I know, you know, I've observed here in the States, indeed, kind of seeing the American newspaper world go through some changes, and indeed your own broadcast world, which is very different from ours. But, you know, it was great to read about the Pulitzer Prizes this week and think, you know what, you have some fine and notable papers in this country doing really amazing work. And that's both at a national level, but also I always love to see the local winners, you know, mm-hmm. the city papers, the state papers, right. doing really, really important work.
Right. Journalism is alive and well in this country.
Sure is. But
one has to choose wisely. And what advice do you give to people listening to us, especially as a Brit, looking in? What do you say about, and I'm not asking for you to cast a bouquet our way or anything, but well, what do you say about making wise choices? What's the advice to a news consumer who really may be perplexed at times about CNN versus Fox versus MSNBC.
I mean, this is the same in Britain as well. And, you know, we have our Brexit story leaving the European Union. Very, very embattled, big debate, you know, a lot of rage and fury on all sides around that. So we have a kind of similar issue. I mean, I guess my advice is use the world we're in now to your advantage, which is we do actually now have a huge range of sources. You know, people talk about the filter bubble. It's terrible. We're all in a digital filter mm-hmm. bubble. I think back to some sort of, you know, landed kind of squire sitting in his dining room on a Sunday morning being served his bacon, reading, you know, whichever newspaper was the only one he would allow in the house, you know. And you think, well, what was that? That was a filter bubble. So in some ways, you know, use the times we live in, but kind of use them wisely as well. So I and many of you, I'm sure, you know, you might have a favoured source, a favoured paper, a favoured station, NPR, you know the values behind your organisation. Understand what its principles are, its values, its maybe its charter, its founding principles. You know, as with us, I know that for NPR, you can find it all on the website. You can understand what the really great values are of public radio in the States. Choose a paper, know where it's coming from. Challenge yourself digitally, whether it's, you know, Facebook or Twitter, follow somebody you think you don't like. Follow a paper or a source
you're not
that
gonna
provokes
make me think
you. You know?
Outside my box.
Well, heavens above, you know, and I know we're all busy and it can feel like a kind of ad, but, you know, in the landscape, there are smart people on all sides. I mean, the other thing I feel strongly is, as a reporter and what we're trying to do editorially, let alone as a consumer of news, is, you know, in the States and in Britain, get outside the bubble. So seek out stories that aren't just about the latest froth, but are a really good reporting story on something that's happened in a particular town or a particular state, a sector you're maybe not so interested in, you know, food, fish, agriculture, understand the opioid crisis, you know, get into the facts and the weeds of what's really happened. And it helps ground you away from what can sometimes feel all the turmoil.
Good advice. Let's go to the phones. Randy in Bemidji, you're on with Mary Hockaday.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, I want to thank you so very much for the wonderful work the BBC does. I rely on your one of the big concerns I have about journalism in the United States is our network closing foreign bureaus, and that limits our on the ground presence. How does the
Randy, we're losing your signal there. I think I know your question is, how does the BBC recruit correspondents into some of the more dangerous parts of the world? And of course, I think of Syria, it comes to mind immediately. How do you protect your journalists on the ground?
Yeah. So we do believe it's really important to maintain that base of people on the ground. And that's true around Britain. And then, of course, globally. And we are fortunate to be funded in a way through a license fee that the British public pays to be able to continue to do that. And we're able to kind of make that case and argument almost directly to the British public to say, you know, this is worth investing in. And, you know, fortunately, they kind of continue to agree with that. So I know that we are lucky compared to some of our, you know, maybe commercially challenged news organisations. But, you know, that said, I would say to any news organisation, even if you're in financial pressure, the most important thing is reporters. You know, just invest in reporters. How do we then, you know, do that? Well, we are able in many countries to recruit locally, and we will have a mix of people from a particular country. But we also have, you know, London-based correspondents who will go and be based in a particular country, you know, for a couple of years, maybe longer. Or, you know, we have London specialists who will kind of fly in and out on occasion. So we put a lot of effort into recruiting, but then also crucially training. You know, anybody who works for us, making sure they're a great journalist, but they really understand the sort of BBC public service reporting values. We also have an absolutely terrific high risk safety team who just go above and beyond to support our journalists to do what they do. That, you know, these guys are not about, well, we're just going to sit in the office and say, that looks a bit dangerous. No, you can't go there. They're all about trying to facilitate, trying to find a way if it can be done safely.
Mm-hmm. Back to the phones. Pete in Burnsville, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, folks. Thank you for the conversation. Ever since I was a kid, I've listened to the BBC on their shortwave broadcasts, and all the way up until the last several years, when it seems like the BBC and Radio France and Radio Nederlands have all taken their shortwave stuff off the air. Is there any of that left? Then maybe I'm just missing it.
No, great question. There are definitely parts of the world that we still broadcast to in shortwave, you know, sometimes because it's the only way to get a signal in. So, you know, we have shortwave headed towards parts of China and, you know, North Korea. And then also parts of the world in South Asia and India, notably, where, you know, people, that's still how they're consuming media. They may not have televisions or they may not have smartphones, you know, so shortwave is still really a habit. So we definitely still do shortwave. But increasingly also we are, you know, our own FM relays in parts of the world. We partner with a lot of broadcasters, just as we do, you know, through APM with the NPR network. We do similar arrangements in other parts of the world. And then increasingly, of course, you know, we are on your phone. Whether that's, you know, through NPR or indeed our direct feeds or online streaming and of course, now podcasts. One of the things that I've been really excited about in the last year, actually, you know, in a way taking the lead from the States, where I think podcasting kind of emerged ahead of us, is to think about some really, really smart editorial offers that we can deliver to a slightly younger generation who maybe don't yet have the public radio habit. And I'd really just like to mention, because I'm here in Minnesota and I've been hearing all about your kind of Scandinavian traditions here, that we've just launched a really fascinating true life crime podcast in partnership with the Norwegian broadcaster NRK called Death in Ice Valley, which is about a still unsolved murder mystery from the 1970s. You've got to listen.
Got to. Well, it's an amazing image you create of someone in a small community, maybe in a far flung place from us, listening on shortwave, and yet an urban listener to the BBC with a smartphone out. I mean, that is a broad spectrum of delivery services.
But, you know, right? I love this because in the end, you know, this is a connected world. And what binds those two people that you've just described is just kind of curiosity. And it's like whatever your background, for whatever reason, you have a kind of impulse and desire to understand the world beyond your own horizons. And I think a lot of the program we do increasingly is about the stories that connect us, as well as, you know, reporting the hard news that sometimes divides us.
We're all curious, right? That's our shared characteristic, right? I want to ask you, Mary Hockaday, about covering the U.S. and its political system. Mm. You know, we Americans believe we are, in fact, the center of the universe. And we're quite often reminded that we're not, but we like to think that. How do you translate American culture, politics, and news to your global audience? And I think of, something like a shooting at a school or some other similar tragedy that might seem out of place to someone in a country where guns are not so much a part of the culture, for example. How do you prepare your journalist to report us to the rest of the globe?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, in some ways, just the same as, you know, reporting anywhere else. There is a difference, which is the world does look to America. You know, the world is endlessly interested in and fascinated. But there's two things there. So, yes, we will do the biggest stories. And a really big school shooting, you know, is a big story. We then do a lot of discussion and debate around it because, you know, we are trying to explain to listeners that there's a particular culture and a real politics and a real debate and divide. And a lot of people around the world are fascinated by that. And it becomes, it's also, we saw in Australia a really big debate about guns in society. So, you know, often we can find a kind of global relevance. But the, there are stories like that. The other thing, though, that sometimes it is important for us to remember is in parts of the world, they're very interested in America, but it's a kind of, well, what does it mean for us? And maybe not so much the local Washington gossip about the latest shenanigans, but, you know, trade. I mean, the trade story is
That's a really big deal
for our listeners. You know, in China, but India, other big trade players, culturally, you know, Korea, North Korea, and what the visit, you know, will the visit happen? Will the talks happen? What's going to happen out of that?
Right.
American policy on Iran. You know, these are really big questions that people in our audiences want to know about because it could be potentially, you know, really significant for them where they live.
Right. Time for one more phone call. Mike in St. Paul, you're on with Mary Hockaday.
Hi. My problem with NPR and the BBC and other mainstream outlets is that they have different standards of evidence and proof for the United States than they do for the United States adversaries.
I'm not sure I know what you mean there.
Give us an example, maybe, Mike.
Well, earlier on this show, the BBC guest said that they have people on the ground and that they can report that Russia obfuscates and disrupts in Syria. Well, okay, that's probably true, but how about America? I look at Iraq, it's pretty disrupted. I look at Libya, it's pretty disrupted.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. So I ground these things in specifics. So I said what I said about Russia because, you know, we know because Russia has at times said as much that, you know, this is an information policy they have. You are completely right to say that, you know, there's big debate about the interventions from America or indeed, you know, Britain too, and a great deal of reporting done by the BBC, you know, back in the day around Britain's intervention in Iraq and all the questions around the intelligence there. You know, similarly with the States, we've had a lot of debate in Britain the last few days about the, you know, most recent limited but nonetheless intervention in Syria. We reported a lot about what happened in Libya and, you know, Britain and France stepping in there and then kind of stepping out and what is the impact of that kind of intervention. So, you know, thanks for the kind of challenge, really, because it gives me a chance, I hope, to try to explain that in a dispassionate, stand-back way, we will look at all these cases and all these stories. The other difference, I suppose, I would say, is that, you know, just about still in our countries, there are systems of holding governments accountable, whether it's, you know, congressional hearings, whether it's free elections, whether it's in Britain, you know, a strong parliamentary system. So there are really different cultures and systems. And you are right to encourage me to point out that it's really important for us that we challenge and hold to account our own government. And then, of course, you know, the states and others just as much as I was trying to explain the specific thinking around understanding what's going on around Russia at the minute.
Right. We have time just for one more quick question here, Mary Hockaday. But this idea of accountability is central to good journalism, isn't it? I mean, ultimately everything grows from that. whether we're holding a government accountable or a person or a party or an act.
Yeah.
Accountability is where it's at. Right?
Yeah. Well, you know, reporting the facts and holding people accountable and providing a platform for a really broad range of views. Yeah.
Mary Hockaday, thank you so much for coming in today. It was a real pleasure and a lot of fun to hear how you do what you do.
It's been a real pleasure and great calls.
Mary Hockaday is the head of the BBC World Service English. She's in town. And thank you again for your time and enjoy your stay in Minnesota.
Thank you.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.